Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss.
Network, yeah, we talk about equipment and methodology, so sit back and start learning.
You're now listening to the Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss.
Hey everybody,
riding up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing.
Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission of
telling you you don't know what you are missing.
Ideas and
some good comedy.
This week I just want to kind of go through some stuff of the week for me. Again, it's a weird hodgepodge, and at the end we've got kind of an overarching question for Nick, and just to see his thoughts and feelings on the subject matter. So first, Nick, thank you for being here.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I'm gonna take a swing at your name again. Is it Braglio?
Close enough.
All right, say it for me.
Braglio.
Okay,
that's the proper Italian pronunciation, although no one from where I live or grew up says it right unless it's their name. So
Braglio. Don't you say it like Mario from
Braglio.
That actually helped me remember it. Well, again, this is a Sunday at the end of a holiday week, so thank you so much for being in here. Round number two, we tried before, and I totally dipped out on you. So thank you so much, Nick.
Oh, that's all good.
All right, man. So the first thing I had on here is we've been doing a bunch of marketing stuff at the data center. And we've been doing company white papers on various things. And these white papers are more or less a single, it should be white paper because it's pretty much like a single sheet of paper. So to me, in my mind, this is more a marketing play. There's very little substance to these things. I guess it's more just a way for a company to say, hey, look, this guy does business with me. You should feel comfortable doing business with me as well. If you see white papers like that, does that mean anything to you? Does that
so do yeah anything for you? Sure. So especially when I'm doing a large procurement, or I'm part of a group that's doing a big procurement, or it doesn't matter if it's a service or a piece of equipment or whatever, one of the things that I will ask with extreme regularity is, who else is using this, or who else is doing this, and can I talk to them, like, without you there? Of any vendor, because there's something to be said about, you know, an honest experience testimonial, I guess, for lack of a better way to describe it, you know, because I don't want to hear that everything is lollipop trees and gumdrop houses, because I know it isn't, right? Tell me the things that I don't want to know. But like, I always get started with what's already available out there. Like, if I can go and I can see, like, customer X, you know, has stuff in data center A, then I'll probably reach out to him directly and say, hey, I'm looking at this. What can you tell me about it? Right. So I find that stuff to be valuable. And I like that, you know, I wouldn't call it a white paper. I think that's just a, you know, veneer over what it really is, which is marketing material. But, you know, I also read white papers too. So like, I like that kind of stuff personally. I know I'm probably not the, you know, I'm probably more the exception, but I enjoy that kind of thing.
No, I mean, that's a great perspective. I was working hard to find value in this other than SEO, right? Like search engine optimization, somebody Googling for something and it happens to come on there. Or just the idea of, hey, you know, these are, you know, potentially this is a big customer, you know, and it's, we're not exactly reaching out to our small customers to do these white papers, right? So we're obviously going for kind of brand value, I guess, the name association with these people. So, the idea that you would reach out to those guys directly, that's pretty cool.
I do that. I've been doing that for 20 years. I mean, as soon as I can find stuff, I don't want to, you know, for an honest opinion, I don't want to talk to the vendor, right? I want to talk to the person that's actually using it, right? And if they give me, if they say 70% positive, that's positive for me. Like, that's overwhelmingly positive for me, because nothing, you know, I always aim for 70 to 80%.
What if they give you 100% positive?
Then I don't believe them and I go to the next one.
That raises another red flag. Yeah.
Yeah. And it may be, you know, I've had that happen before where something is like, I was not able to find a really strong downside. So, but I did go on and on and on until I found, you know, enough people that said, like, this is what they say is accurate. Right. And that's really all I'm looking for, is if what you're telling me is accurate, then I can glaze over whatever the negative pieces are. Right. Because there are going to be some. If there aren't any, then, you know, you're not looking hard enough.
Yeah, as you say, you just haven't found them yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I mean, yeah, I truly enjoy that perspective. All right. You ready to shift gears really fast?
Sure, why not?
I love Kaizo Mario hacks. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about right now?
I have no clue what you're talking about.
So a long time ago, this guy made this editor. I think it's like Windows-based. It's called Lunar Magic, and it lets you make custom Super Mario World levels, and they call them Kaizo Mario hacks. Kaizo specifically because they are a specifically difficult flavor of hack, and people like build in all this ASM is what they call it. So they'll have like customized bosses, custom mechanics, like you can go through the screen, like wrap around, or you can double jump. It's crazy stuff like that. But you know what's so funny is I don't want to play them. I just want to watch other people play them. It's so strange. It's so strange how boring I've gotten that I don't actually even want to do it myself. I just want to watch other people because it does look painful and there is a lot of skill associated with it. So I just think it's so strange.
Is this like a Twitch thing where you watch people play?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Of course.
My oldest son has been asking for Twitch for like 2 years, and I'm just like, I don't know. I haven't done it yet.
How old is your oldest son?
He turns 11 tomorrow.
Okay. I mean, that seems like the sweet spot. It seems like kids nowadays are super into like YouTube or kind of moving over towards the Twitch side.
He likes both. Right now, he only has access to YouTube with parental controls on it. And we'll probably do the same thing with Twitch, assuming I can do it. I think, doesn't it come with Amazon Prime or something now?
You can get a free, so you can subscribe to people. Like you can, for your favorite Twitch streamers, you can subscribe to them and it gives them like, I think they get, it costs $5 and they get $2.50 of that, your Twitch streamer. But everybody who gets Amazon Prime, you get a free Twitch subscription you can give to somebody if you want. Yeah. But I don't know, man. I was, you know, at first I was sort of confused by it. And then I think about it too. It's like people want to watch the NFL, but they don't want to go out there and play. They don't want to put on pads and get hit, you know?
Yep.
So I think it's somewhat similar. You know, I was thinking too, I like watching people who are experts at what they do. I love skill and seeing it implemented, right? Like on YouTube, I subscribe to the Corning Museum of Glass, right? So they'll have these guests, glass blowers, come in and teach classes and stuff, and that stuff blows me away watching people do that stuff.
That's very cool. When I was in art school, glass was one of the classes I really wanted to take, but it was not on campus and I was really lazy, so it was like, you know, I would have had to drive to get there. Gotcha. And I didn't want to do that, so I just and the guy was world renowned, like he has ornaments and stuff on the White House Christmas tree, and like I just never did it. Well, I stuck with jewelry and photography, and I never did it.
I would love to get in there and try some of that stuff, but I forgot you were an art guy. I don't know. It's not incongruous because I've met a lot of creative people in IT. It's just, I don't know. You know, it sort of surprises you every time.
Yeah, I paid my way through art school building networks. And then when I got done, I was like, I'm gonna make twice as much money than I would ever make as an artist. I'm just gonna keep doing this.
There you go, man. There you go. You know, so I was kind of looking back at like, what are the top things I watch on Twitch? Because that's what I do in my downtime. It like, that's what switches my brain off. You know, if I've got a few minutes here or there, and I'll watch Super Mario World hacks, you know, people playing Kaizo hacks. I'll watch retro gaming. So people playing NES stuff or SNES. I love that stuff.
Nice.
And then I watch people play chess. Which is funny too, because I never play chess in real life, but I enjoy watching like Hikaru Nakamura. He's like the US number one grandmaster chess champion. And so whenever he's playing, he gives you an insight into how his brain works because he can draw arrows and stuff while he's in mid game. And his mouth is going 100 miles an hour. He's like, I assume they'll do this and then I'll go here and here and here. And then, you know, he'll play like speed chess. And so after 5 seconds, his opponent will make a move and then he'll just instantly adjust and then he'll just start saying all these things he's gonna do. It kind of breaks my brain seeing how fast they can actually just comprehend. And they also, who's at chess.com, they have these I can't remember what they call it, but it's like these puzzles, and so you get 3 minutes and they'll pop up these progressively more difficult puzzles, and so they'll look at it and it's like just the pattern recognition in their brains, they will almost instantly move. They'll know what the next move is.
And yeah, I mean, it's a series of memorized movements, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know a whole lot about chess, but my experience playing it is, and this is how my brain works with everything's a pattern, right? Everything's a pattern and a memorized pattern.
For sure. Most,
and chess seems very much like that. I'm not good at it, but I feel like I've consciously avoided it because I tend to be a bit obsessive, and I would like go 100% into it and the world would disappear around me for like 2 years as I memorized everything. So I've consciously avoided it. My office mates are always playing it. There's always a long game going where one of them's moving and the other one's, you know, and it'll go on for, I think the longest one they had was like 18 months long.
Jeez.
Or something. This tape, the chessboard's always set up in the office.
I don't want to think about anything that long. That's it. I'm an instant gratification guy, I think.
Yeah, I am kind of like that too. But I definitely get like watching the experts. Like when I want to wind down, like I've been a skateboarder for like 31 years, right? And back in the day, you know, in the late 80s when I started, like you just had a magazine. Like that was the only thing you could do, right? To try to learn new stuff or see what the pros were doing. And then, you know, and now that I'm old and falling apart, like I can go to YouTube and I can watch that, like how-tos, like tricks I was never able to master. When I want my brain to shut off, I just go and I try to watch the mechanics of those things that I could never figure out. And once in a while, I can go out and actually do it afterwards. Just watching these, you know, slow motion experts do their thing where they break down like, you know, here's where this foot goes and here's where that, and here's how you kick and where the weight distribution is. And it's really just all physics, right? And balance. And so that I get it. Like I totally get watching the game. I would probably get into watching the retro gamers too, because I was a big time Atari Nintendo kid.
As I say, I also like watching speed running. So it's basically complete a game as fast as you possibly can. There's different flavors. Like some will say no like exploits or whatever, because there's in virtually every game, there's a bug of some sort, and these guys learn all these complicated ways to exploit them. Some of them aren't that complicated, but it's truly fascinating to watch your childhood torn apart like that. I mean, like, they're doing AGDQ, Awesome Games Done Quick, that's coming up in, I think, like a week. I think it starts next week. It's always right after New Year's or right very near New Year's. And so it's a week-long speed gaming marathon, so 24 hours for an entire week. It is, they'll just go from one game to the next and they'll speed game it. And there's always a, there's always like retro blocks in there. And then there's also my favorite part, that do awful games done quick. So they'll find these obscure, horrible, bizarre games that for some reason people decide to speed run. And it's, there's let's see, what's an awful, I think Die Hard, the NES Die Hard games in there. They complete that in like 5 minutes. There's these weird Bible games that they complete.
I did not know those existed until like a couple of years ago. A guy that worked with us for a little bit, like we had a Christmas party and we're like, yeah, we're going to do some retro gaming. We got an arcade cabinet in the office, a bunch of MAME ROMs on it. He's like, I'll bring some games in my Nintendo. I'm like, well, you don't need to. And he's like, no, I will. And so he brought them and it was like literally a stack of Bible games. And I was like, that's cool, you know, whatever, if you want to, you know, have at it.
It is.
I'm not going to judge you, but those don't look entertaining to me at all.
So you definitely look up AGDQ schedule, because they have it all laid out there. And so you can find your very favorite games that you loved as a child and watch them just tear them apart. It is so fascinating, because there's like, there's a speedrunner called like Mitch Flower Power, and he plays, in my opinion, one of the greatest games of all time, Super Mario Brothers 3. And you watch him speedrun, like, so every night, you know, he's up there, he'll run through the game, because I think he's doing 100%, where it's like you have to play all levels and the Hammer Bros, and just the way he flows through all the levels, it's virtually nonstop movement and precise timing.
It's crazy,
it's
dude.
So nuts. And so he'll complete the whole game, every single level, everything, in somewhere around like 51 minutes or something.
And I used to fancy myself a gamer. You know, in the 90s, we had a LAN in the apartment, and very early, we were a beta tester for SDSL. And like people come over and bring their big rigs and play and whatever. And I wasn't great, but I fancied myself a gamer up until probably about 2001, about a year after I got married. And so my son is like playing Fortnite with his friends now. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, these guys are on. And like, I have access, like that's part of the deal is I have unfettered access to everything electronic that all, both my kids have. And so I know his username. I'm like, I'm going to install this on my PC and I'm going to just wipe the floor with these guys, right? They're 10-year-old kids, right? Just this year.
Yeah.
And so I get it all set up and I join their game. And my oldest son comes running in here and he's like, hey, is this you? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, do you want to play with us? I'm like, yeah, how about you guys against me? Because I'll probably just beat you guys. Oh, dude, it wasn't even close. They annihilated me. Like they completely wiped the floor. It was, I mean, it was like, it was comically bad.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't even close. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I'm done. And then they proceeded to mock me for about 15 minutes. Deservedly.
Oh yeah. Right? Teabagging you end game. Yeah, I tried playing Fortnite one time with my kids, and man, it is just not my cup of tea. I used to play a lot of first-person shooters, you know, like Half-Life, Half-Life 2. Quake 3 Arena was really my favorite of all. You know, like I said, I was an instant gratification guy. There's almost nothing more instant gratification. That's what it's designed for, is just rapid movement. And then you go to Fortnite, and then they introduce this concept of building and all that stuff, and it's just... it's so cumbersome. Like I used to play paintball back in the day when I was like 16 and 17 and all I played was speedball. That's like, just put me out with a bare number of obstacles and I'm going to run full speed at everybody. I love
that. Yeah, dude, speedball's where it's at. My college roommate, his dad owned a paintball field. So like we were constantly playing. I got to play for free. So we were always out there playing, always speedball. Yeah. I wasn't any good, but it was really fun.
I used to love it. I mean, I would play in like a white t-shirt and shorts. And I would just run. And you'd see these guys in like full camo and they wanted to go hide in the woods. And it's like, dude, this is, oh, if I wanted to sit and watch paint dry, I would stay at home. Yeah. You know? It's just,
there's a video of me probably 1993 or 92. We're playing that paintball like that, but we're playing like around. So I've known the guy I lived with in college. I've known since we were like kindergarten, right? Playing around his house. He lived out in the country. And his little sister was following me around with a video camera and like, you're going to get me shot, you know? And what? Yeah. Sorry. And so she's following me around. So everybody knew where I was all the time. And around this corner, she filmed me with this giant video camera, right? And my buddy, like, he goes like this and shoots me right in the junk. And like, these guys knew they turned the power up on their guns. Dude, I threw up. And there's this video of me out there this somewhere, and they keep threatening to put it on YouTube. I'm like, do it, man. Why not? Yeah, I totally threw up. Like that was some pretty severe pain and bruising, I might add.
Oh, I never got anything too bad. I had some bruises that lasted, you know, like 8 or 9 months, but I never got it too terrible when I played out there.
That's the worst I ever got it.
I was always broke. I was always barely able to play every time I played. It was like having
the only reason I got to play is because it was free because his dad owned the field. Hey, so man. There's three or four of us and we all played for free.
Do what you got to do. Get in there.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, for sure, man. Oh, man. We really went off a tangent. I love that. but yeah. Yeah, that's kind of bringing it back. I love watching anybody who's great at what they do. So like, like magicians, I love that stuff where it's just, you know, like once you learn a few slides and things like that, you know what they're doing, but it's so smooth and so practiced that even though you know exactly what's happening in front of you, you can't see it. That blows my mind. I love that stuff.
Yeah. That's cool too. I like that stuff too.
All right, man. So let's move over to something technical. So what was I doing? I was troubleshooting a VPN issue. We got called because our sister company, we administer, so we do the networks for all of the companies under this umbrella, and then like these other guys do kind of the IT stuff, so they're doing like PC support for all the groups and they take care of the email servers. Oh, thank god,
that's a thankless job, dude.
I know, it's like email admins, teachers, and mental health workers, they're all saints.
Thank you.
Oh man, but yeah, they were doing all that stuff for us, and they were calling saying the VPN wasn't connecting. And so, man, of course they control the Radius server, right? Because it's a domain controller on the back end, so we can't touch that. But we're beating our heads against the rest of this stuff, and it just reminded me. I mean, ultimately it was their problem, and we were able to kind of help them get to that conclusion, but it just brings me back to how frustrated I get every time I'm only in control of a small portion of it, right? And then you instantly have to start thinking, all right, well, how do I test this? So we added our Radius server to their firewall, and of course it instantly connected, you know, and then we're trying with local accounts. And it's like, okay, this is working fine. And just, you know, you've got to do all of these gymnastics because there's this one piece, the one piece that you really know is the problem. You can't touch it. You can't look at the logs. You can't do anything. And then you can, you know, try and get them on the phone. Of course, they're running lean like every IT team. And so they're doing all these different things in multiple directions. And you're trying to like test it and then, you know, make tweaks. And then just, oh man, just the back and forth of that stuff drives me crazy. And
I'm always frustrated by the fact that I get it. I mean, I understand why. But it's usually, especially in networking, and to a lesser extent, security, depending on who runs like the middle boxes, right? Where you're always proving that it's not your problem.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that should be like the ISP mantra, right? Prove it's not your problem. And at some point, that just becomes gospel, right? You understand that that's part of the gig is... But, you know, where it starts to break down is when you start to get jaded about it, you know, and it gets frustrating and you just, you know, you don't want to talk, you don't want to feel like you have to do that anymore. But sadly, that is the state of networking in general, and especially running a service provider of any kind. Really, it's not your fault. Like I've seen on the Wisp Talk group, you know, I don't post as much in there as I used to, but I like to lurk and read and stuff. And like, you know, there's people saying like customers calling them in the middle of the night complaining that their game is laggy or whatever. And it's totally outside of the service provider's control. But really to explain that to somebody in that mindset and, you know, that has that level of knowledge, you know, they know enough to be dangerous, right? They understand the internet is a thing and IP addresses and latency and ping time. But what they don't understand is that every single segment is its own, you know, it's basically its own failure domain, right? And that the ISP doesn't control 9/10 of them and they just are pissed.
You know, what gets me too, kind of in that vein is, your sphere of control, right? I mean, that's ultimately what we're talking about. And kind of in the ISP world too, we have certain customers and, you know, they're using the data center for services and they're connecting remote offices. Say this remote office, Chicago or whatever, you know, we're in Bryan College Station or Houston, wherever you happen to be, they're having problems.
Mm-hmm.
And the customer hangs off an ISP up there. In our data center, on our services, on our internet services, we give an insane SLA, 100% SLA, right? We're guaranteeing you that it's going to be up. And so when something happens, they never care what the reason is. The reason never matters. The fact that I'm telling them, I'm selling you the service and it's always going to be here is all that matters to them. And I get that, you know? So it's kind of like if somebody sells me a car and a spark plug goes bad the next day, it's like, I kind of don't care what the problem was. It's like, dude, you just sold me this thing and it's breaking already. You know, so it's like, I kind of get that. You're going to be upset. And also, even in those scenarios where they do understand, they sometimes need a scapegoat, right? So, or if there's not good communication all the way up the chain, right? If I'm just talking to the level one network tech, you know, that's going to go to the team lead. And then from the team lead to, you know, the guy that's over the department, then there's going to be layers of separation to the guy at the top. And if the guy at the top only hears, hey, we had a problem with internet from that data center, you know, that's tarnishing my reputation. So when it comes around for renewal time, they only have this vague recollection, this game of telephone that they played with their internal peer. So it's, you can't completely insulate yourself from that.
You never can. You know, and it's one of those, I learned early on when I was running a early broadband ISP close to 20 years ago now, I had some, you know, we were fairly large, you know, regional, and I had a customer that used to be my competition. Like he ran a competing ISP and he kind of got out of the game whenever it was mostly dial-up and ISDN, right? Whenever broadband started to come up he kind of just bowed out, graciously sold it off and was done. But he knew what he was doing. And he also was, he was fairly temperamental. Like, he wasn't nice when he had a problem. And we had problems just like anybody else, you know. And he would call and he would, you know, he wouldn't speak to anyone but me. And I had, you know, tech support people and whatever in front of me. And he would just call them every name in the book until, I mean, he was very, I mean, he was very demeaning to them. And so I used to just give it right back to him. I was young, you know, I was like 27 or something. And I just give it right back to him. And it just would escalate and escalate and escalate. And I'd go home and I'd talk to my wife and be like, man, I just don't know what to do about this guy. Like, he's just, I can't get anywhere with him. You know, he calls me names and, you know, and then I lose my, you know, I was kind of a hothead back then, and I'd give it back to him. And she's like, why don't you just be nice? And I was like, well, I don't want to do that, man. He doesn't deserve that. And she's like, well, you don't know what he's got going on. Just be nice to him and see what happens. And so the next time, you know, a couple months go by, you know, we had some kind of BGP flap or whatever. And he called and he would only talk to me, and he was calling me every name in the book. And I was like grossly nice to him. Like, it wasn't fake. Like, I genuinely was trying to help, but I was just, the meaner he would get, the nicer I would get. And he just hung up. I didn't know how to deal with that. And he called back, and maybe 10 minutes later, and he was never rude again after that. Like, when he realized, like, look, man, we genuinely want to solve your problem. Yeah. Like, we're not doing this on purpose. Like, we want to solve your problem. Like, he was totally cool for the duration of the time I was there after that. So it's one of those things, like, you know, you tend to, human nature is, you know, you keep getting blamed for something that isn't your fault. At some point, you're going to be unhappy about it, and you're probably going to lash out. But, like, no good ever comes from that.
Yeah.
It always ends up being a bad experience for everybody.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. You don't know what happened to that guy this month, this week, yesterday, today. I mean, you don't know his story, what he's carrying with him. And then you also don't know what his history is, because anybody who's ever had to deal with AT&T on a regular basis, they're going to be a little gun shy. You know what I mean? It's like, sometimes you just get so used to getting beat that when somebody reaches down to pet you, you might be nervous and shy away a little bit, you know? And so I've met people who, man, they know that this is how you have to deal with it. And if you want to cut through the bullshit, you got to be an asshole. And so they just come at you guns hot. And,
yep.
I think you're 100% right. You can disarm those people by just, trying to be as open and honest as you can and forthright and try and help them. And something I always tell people, I said, is this is my problem. I was like, and it's an issue on our end, whether it is or not, I'm going to treat it like it is. And so if you find out that you figure out there's a problem in your network somewhere, you tell me, because we're going to be grinding away on this thing until you tell me to stop. Like, even if I can almost unequivocally show you that it's your problem, I will keep investigating until you do tell me that it's your problem. So if you don't email me, I'm going to call you in 8 hours, because I'm still going to be working on this. I need you to tell me to stop at some point. So I think that takes people back a little bit. You know, there's just, you're not accustomed to, because in the telecom world, it's always not my problem. And then they try and get you off the phone as quick as possible. But you know what? I've never been in one of those call centers, and I bet those guys have 100 tickets sitting there waiting in their queue, right?
Oh, I'm sure.
So they're just trying to survive the day and get through and move on. So I totally get it, because I bet you 90 out of 100 of those actually is the customer's problem.
I'm sure.
Because if my experience is any example of that, I've run into, I mean, virtually, oh man, we get calls most of the time. We get calls about they're having internet issues. First thing we do, like, automatically is, what's their rate limit? And then we look at their bandwidth graphs, and they're almost always pegged.
Yep.
It's like, what started at 7 a.m. this morning? Because here's your bandwidth graph, and it's completely maxed. You know, so it's almost always their problem of some sort.
Yeah, but customer service, really, I mean, at the end of the day, you're in technology, really, you're in customer service. Mm-hmm. Right. You might have it wrapped around. And so that what my wife told me that day in 2000 or 2001, whenever it was, I've operated with that as my MO ever since, because it made me realize, like, my job is to make them make them feel better until we figure out what the problem is. And part of that responsibility might be me figuring out what the problem is. It likely is. But at the same time, I can't just shut the door and say, leave me alone until I figure out what's going on here. I got to treat them like I would treat my mom who calls me with a technical problem, right?
I probably have the least patience for my mom when she calls me. So that's
what's that?
I said that's not a good example for me because I have the least patience with my mom.
Yeah, I'm not great at that either. But in theory, it sort of makes sense.
Yeah, for
like
sure.
I was helping my mom with PayPal the other day. Like she just, you know, she's selling a horse or whatever, and they wanted to pay her with PayPal. And I'm just like, okay, well, you know, and I'm walking her through it, and I'm traveling, so I'm in the airport, right? So I'm just walking her through, like, what do you see on the screen? So I just try to be that way, because like as soon as you're not, then it just is a bad day for everybody. Yeah, it
goes downhill quickly. It's crazy to think that you'd light people up on the phone, because it's like for the longest time I wanted everybody to like me. So it was like I would never start yelling at somebody. I think that's hilarious.
I was really different back then, you know. I was real different. Like I have had severe imposter syndrome for the entirety of my career, right? Because
preaching to the choir.
Well, my first technical job, I worked at this place when I was telling you about, I was in art school and I would do network installs in K-12s. And the guy who was my manager, would constantly question why I was even there, because I wasn't a computer science student. Like, why are you bothering doing this? Right. Like, why are you here? And he also paid me less than everybody else. I was a team lead. He paid me less than every other single person on my team. Some of them had zero experience. And I still made like $2 an hour less than them because of that. So that really colored my entire technical career, that like I needed to work twice as hard to prove that I was like I should be there. And so like, you know, when I was running the ISP, I was really young. I was like 26 or 27 and I was newly married. I had I just moved here from, you know, like an hour away. I had no friends and I had I became a manager like the second day I was there. So not only was I the network architect, I also managed all the technical people. And so I was way too young and I was just like going to prove to everybody that like I was the boss and I was in charge. And it took me 18 months to figure out that like that was probably the wrong way to do it. And I'd learned from that, right? And you know, after that I was, you know, I'd like to think I was an okay boss after that, but you know, for a while it was rough getting like that. I'd light people up on the phone, you know. It was just a very different world.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. When I was in I was in college, I was doing computer science, but I went to a technical school, so I like to call it high school 2.0, really. Because, I mean, I was in like, you know, I mean, I was in math classes with diesel mechanics and dental technicians, and so, you know what I mean? So it's not like, I wasn't like doing advanced coursework on anyway, I digress. I had a programming teacher, and we were doing Visual Basic in that class, and that was when I really figured out this is what I want to do. Because Visual Basic, it was just, I could make things so fast and so dirty, which is, says a lot about my personality. It's just, I can, you know, I can get from point A to point B so much quicker now. Boom, done. I like this. But we went to a programming competition and you got to pick a partner. And so I picked my friend Junior. He was the biggest screw off in the class. I was the second biggest one. I love the class and I would get it done, but I would only do the bare minimum. Like I wouldn't do, you know, I wouldn't do all the homework just the way you're supposed to. I would do it as efficiently as possible. Right. And so, cause that's the way my brain works. That's the way I work. So it wasn't always exactly what the teacher wanted to see. And he could see that I wasn't putting in as much work as his star students. Anyway, at this programming competition, I beat his star students. Junior just looked up three things in the book for me. So it was me against his star students, and I beat him. And when we were in the hall afterwards, he was saying, yeah, if they had just had more time, they would have blah, blah, blah. I don't remember any of the rest. I just remember him saying that had they had more time, they would have beaten me. That was him saying, they're actually better than you. They just needed more time to prove it. And I was thinking, you know what? I'm your student too. You know, you taught me as well. And here I am, just because I don't kiss your ass as much as they do, all of a sudden I'm not worthy of succeeding. And man, that put a bug up my butt. I was just, after that, I was like, I'll show you. You know, it was basically, I'm going to show you how much better I can be than your star students. You know?
Yeah, that's not something as a teacher that he should have said.
You know, but no, it's...
But I definitely understand the motivation. There is no better way to motivate me than to tell me I can't do something.
Oh, it motivated me. And I still carry that with me today. That I can never rely on anybody else's approval. I only need my own, right? I just do what I can to the best of my abilities, and I don't require anybody else to make me to say, good boy, you did a good job. I've never had that in my life, and I never need it. And I don't need your permission to do anything, and I don't need your approval. So I've basically been living my life in spite of that kind of crap.
Good spot to be in, man. But you know, like I always tell my kids, you know, you either win or you learn. And when you learn, you're going to get a heck of a lot more than when you win.
Yeah.
And it's the same, conceptually the same.
Yeah. Yeah. If you happen to pick the right sequences to make this work right the very first time, good for you. You're going to forget how you did it. But if you do it wrong 60 times, you're probably going to remember the right way you did it.
And you'll know every little esoteric detail under the hood.
That's definitely the stuff that sticks with me.
Yeah, me too.
So something else kind of, I think, that sort of tail ends off of that is last week I let my lead tech take a conference call for the first time. And it was kind of an upset customer after something transpired or whatever, and he was going to be on the phone with him. And I was tempted to dial in to the Meet Me bridge, and I didn't. I said, you know what? He's going to handle this. I'm not going to listen in. I'm not going to, you know, make sure all the right things are said. I'm just going to trust. I mean, he's been my top guy for 2 years, you know, so he's there. He's earned it. He's still young. Still sometimes says the wrong thing at the wrong time. Gets a little bit passionate about things. But, you know, somebody told me one time, without giving somebody the ability to fail, you're not giving them the ability to succeed, right?
Yeah, that's true.
They're both there, and you just got to let them ride. It was just, I don't know. It was kind of scary for me, gave me anxiety for a minute, and then I just let it go and went about my day. And it was so much nicer not having to burn that brain energy on that thing to be able to let that sort of thing go. And I think it also, too, right, it shows him that I trust him. And
That's huge, too. Yeah. Give him the responsibility and let him run with it. I used to tell my guys, you know, you're going to mess something up every once in a while because I'm going to trust you with something, and I'm going to trust you with something that's probably, you know, 1 out of 10 times, it's probably going to be a little bit higher than I have before, and you may mess it up, right? But it's not how many plates you keep spinning in the air at the same time. It's how you pick them up when they fall, because they're going to fall. Mm. We just, you know, don't point fingers. Let's circle the wagon, figure out the problem, triage, move on to the next thing. And then the next day you tell me what you learned from it. Yeah. And, you know, you give them that amount of trust and it'll build their confidence. And that failure window goes way down. Like, the more times they do it, at least that's been my experience.
Yeah.
But I've had I've been very lucky in my career that in the times when I was in that position where, you know, I had a team or whatever, like, they were all great. Like, they were all really good. And I didn't have to worry about, like, you know, such and such might bug out without finishing this thing that's critical, right? And go home because it's Friday night or whatever. I didn't have to worry about that. And I think that's a huge caveat that a lot of people, you know, don't have that. You know, if you have that, man, play the lottery. Because it's good. It's a good thing to have.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think it teaches people communication a lot, too.
Yeah.
You know, the more you trust them. Because it's... failure, to me, isn't necessarily failure unless I get surprised by it. It's when something goes wrong or something doesn't get finished and nobody else knows about it. oh, that's when it, you know, it's like, I almost fixed the brakes on the car. You probably should tell me that you didn't finish them. You know, that's fine. I just won't drive the car today. You know, it's the little things like that. And, fortunately I haven't had any, big problems with that. They're just the little things, you know, and,
yeah.
I think a lot of that too is trust, right? Being able to trust your employees, being able to trust you that if something goes wrong, you're not going to blow up on them. You know, you're not going to scream at them in front of everybody else. You're just going to see it for what it is, a learning opportunity, and you're going to pick up and move from there. And, I don't think everybody's worked for a bad boss, or rather, I don't think everybody's worked for a good boss, but everybody remembers a bad boss somewhere in their history, right? So I think there's a lot of average bosses, and that's fine, but really those bad ones stick out. And I think once you get one or two of those, you realize you don't want to be that person. So it makes me wonder, those people that are terrible at management, have they just never had that bad boss, or did they like the way the bad boss got things done? And they're like, man, maybe I could do that too. I'm not sure.
You know, some of that, I think, is probably just lack of social IQ. Like they don't care, or they just don't, they're totally oblivious to it. Like, I'm getting this thing done and I have tunnel vision for this thing. And if this thing gets done, I'm great. Doesn't matter, like, that I've left a wake of bodies, you know, around me. And I've been lucky. Like, I've really only had like one boss that I didn't enjoy working for. And he wasn't bad per se. Well, I don't know. I talked about him a little bit ago, but you know, I didn't enjoy working for him. Right. Outside of work, he was a nice enough guy, but like, he couldn't grok why I was even there. And he let me know that in no uncertain terms. And I've been lucky ever since then. Yeah. I've always had pretty good support. You know, my expectations are pretty reasonable. I think, you know, I want to be respected. I don't want to be taken advantage of. I don't want to be talked down to. You know, the things that, you know, just common courtesy kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah. Treat me like you would somebody standing in front of you in line at the bank.
Yeah. Yeah,
like a regular human being.
Yeah.
Some people forget that.
It's a sad state of affairs in some instances, I think.
But that's life, you know, right? And you can move on. Like, once you have kids too, I think, you know, I think about them and it's like, they're going to run into those people. And, you know, as much as I want to shield them from that kind of thing, I also want them to go ahead and experience that and see that it's not life ending and that you can pick up and move beyond that. Cause I had some of those experiences pretty young. And so I think it was somewhat good to do that. I think it pushed me back a little ways. I've got problems. I've got problems with male authority figures in particular. But beyond that, I've done a lot of work, got a lot better. I think it's good to have your eyes open to that stuff.
I'm a big fan of, you know, a little bit of, what's the word I'm looking for? Basically, you know, you need a little bit of rough patch, right? Because then you understand like how to deal with it. Like, if you've never dealt with anything that is not ideal, then when something that's not ideal happens or that isn't handled for you, you don't know how to do it.
Yeah. Adversity, right?
Adversity. I kept thinking diversity, but it was adversity. Yeah. But yeah, you need a little bit of adversity in your life. And we try to give that to the kids too, you know, because that's how they're going to learn. Like, it's not, like I said, it's not all lollipop trees and gumdrop houses.
Yeah.
Most of it's not, actually. Yeah. You got to find those things and hold on to them.
That's what we tell our kids. It's like, you know, life's going to suck sometimes. You're going to be miserable sometimes. You're going to be sad. I was like, but you know, you'll also be happy. You'll be excited. And you just want, you know, there to be more of the good stuff than the bad stuff. And sometimes, especially if you decide for a career in IT, it will be the inverse of that for a little bit. Hopefully it doesn't stay that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. That's awesome. Well, do you ever do any access control stuff? I'm just going to keep shifting gears on you, by the way.
No, it's okay. I have done a fair amount of NAC and Radius and other things in the past.
How about physical access control?
I've done camera systems. So we used to have a couple big dogs in the house, and I travel a fair amount. And so they both passed away, and it was before we got another one. I was like, I want a security system. And we live in like a very suburban, you know, beige neighborhood, right? It's not like we live in Cabrini Green or, you know, in inner city of, you know, of Chicago or something where there's, you know, you got to worry about stuff. Like, we could leave our doors unlocked every night and be fine. Yeah. We don't, but we could.
Right.
And so she's like, I want the security system. And I was like, okay. So what I heard is build a security system.
Oh.
So I built, you know, I put some external cameras around, and I bought a bunch of door sensors. And so I built all that, and I got a buddy that does it, that does internet access for like Greek houses and stuff. And I've known him since the 90s, and he started doing camera systems. And so he would call me, and we'd go back and forth. So I've kind of peripherally done some of that stuff. We did buy an electronic door lock thing for an office space, although it hasn't actually been installed yet. So I know enough to be dangerous, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, I ran across some stuff that was interesting the other day. I like, I don't know if anybody else does this, but I like going to AliExpress and just kind of like seeing where I end up down the rabbit hole. And so I've done, I don't know about a lot of access control, but I've done a chunk of it with like EST systems and Software House and some various different incarnations of other vendor stuff. I've even kind of like custom made some stuff to kind of fit in to fill gaps and bits and pieces and stuff, either with microcontrollers like mm-hmm. Arduinos, and done some stuff like that. And then also I was doing that for a while, and then I shied away from using microcontrollers in favor of big chunky parts like relays with timers on them and solid state, you know, devices, because I found when I make something with a microcontroller, while it's there and it's reliable and it's very compact, nobody else can work on it. So it's, you know, because it's, you know, it's all inside a little blob. But if I make big, old school, chunky components and then make diagrams and everything's got a light on it, then other people can work on it. So it's, you know, helping everybody else learn new skills is sort of what I went to on that stuff. But there's this... they used to be called ZK Access, I think, over here in the States. JJ turned me on to it. He ended up using it, and it was really affordable stuff. And so I was just looking at access control, and I saw they've changed their name to ZK Techo now. And you can buy, excuse me, their components straight off of AliExpress now.
Really?
Which is interesting. I'm not sure why you wouldn't have to go through a distributor, which makes you wonder if they're knockoff. I don't know. Maybe they
are. I'll bet you they are.
They might be, but you could buy a bunch
AliExpress.
Of
AliExpress.
But
I make no mistake, I buy stuff off there.
Oh, I do too. And the ZTA Techo stuff, I mean, they're a Chinese brand. It's manufactured. They have a US-based site where you can buy the stuff from and everything. But you can buy like the door controller, so like 2-door, 4-door, 6-door, I think. No, 1-door, 2-door, 4-door, I think is what they break it down in. But you can buy those for, I think you can buy the 4-door one for like $80. Straight from AliExpress. And the software is available from the US site. So you can just pull it off the site and have an access control system right there for pennies compared to, because I got some pricing from them. That same $80 one is like $350 over here in the States. Yeah.
Wow.
So it makes me, now, should you worry about those sorts of things? Because they're all IP enabled, right? These remote panels pull back on an IP network. And if you're buying, you know, AliExpress.
That was going to be my next question. Have you done any type of TCP dump on?
I have not, which makes me curious, right? So
the first camera system I built, I bought these $30 Chinese cameras, right? And I have a Bro IDS that runs in the basement. And, you know, I've got my network in this house is more complicated than a lot of small WISPs, right? At one point it was all MPLS and there were multiple routers. You know, it's complicated, right? I got a full rack in the basement. And I started watching and I was like, what are these talking to? And it's some random Chinese IP and the packet decode is pretty benign, right? It's basically like a phone home so you can use the mobile app kind of thing. So, and the ones I were using, there wasn't even encrypted, right? So I could actually look at the payload and see like, this is pretty benign, right? This is basically like, here's my address. Here's how you talk to me. I'm trying to open up UPnP, which I don't support. So I ended up carving all those off into their own IoT VLAN. There's no access to the outside world. All they can talk to is the camera system, like the front end. Right. And that solved that problem. Yeah. But like ever since then, I am constantly looking at what is entering and leaving my network. Flow data, bro logs, everything, right? Because I'm like paranoid because of that. And there's so much crap in my house that's IP enabled that like, you know, it's getting to the point where like I need a full-time IT manager for the freaking house.
That's what your kids are for.
Put them to work.
My kids aren't that interested in IT and stuff, but you're right. Like with that's exactly what I was worried about. The phone home aspect of this, you know, it's like, you know, if I have a temperature sensor that's IP enabled, do I really care if China's getting my temperature information? Obviously they could use it for a backdoor or something like that. But I was thinking like your access control system, that could be, you know.
That's probably bad news.
Yeah, I mean, that could be. But it's so inexpensive. If it actually
works. How about you filter it, right?
Yeah. If you could just lock it down network-wise and just make sure that it doesn't really have external access. And then even if you're worried about some kind of compromise coming out of this thing, like it's got some kind of time bomb waiting in it, I guess you could just protect the rest of the network from it as well.
Most of these things are pretty easy to isolate. Like even people that aren't, you know, technically savvy, like you get a camera, you don't need to see it from outside your house. Just give it the wrong default gateway, right? It's probably not going to be able to, unless it's got V6, which none of them do, you know, it's not going to know like, oh, I need to ARP for this other thing, right? Right. If it's got V6, it'll know, hey, well, there's my router, right? Because it's part of the neighbor discovery process. None of them have it.
Right. As much of an advocate as you are for V6, I guess the Internet of Things is probably one of those scary ones to have on V6, right?
Well, I mean, I think for me, I've been doing it so long that it's just another thing. But like for folks that aren't familiar with it, like they're not going to.
Right?
Yeah, it's most people. Like they're not going to get that. Like you don't need DHCP for full connectivity, right? For end-to-end connectivity, no. You know, NAT is not security. I'll say it a million times. There's nothing in the middle, right? You don't need literally nothing but a router and a device. And all you have to do is turn it on. The default is router, you know, RA is enabled. Those things have access. And it's not like, and it's unfettered access, right? Unless you've got IPv6 firewall rules, which I guarantee you don't, if you don't know that much about it, right? It's going to be a thing, but you know, I have it enabled on my IoT VLAN and it's only inbound filtered. So I've done that on purpose, right? So I wrote an alarm that says if anything on this segment starts talking V6 outbound, I want to know about it, right? Because that means like a firmware update has happened that one, I didn't push, and two, it's enabled IPv6. There's no neighbors in the neighbor table on that except for the router, right? There's nothing there. So if that happens, I want to know about it because then I'm going to be like excited.
Yeah, finally something's going on. Excellent. All right. So enough of my AliExpress musings because there's some weird stuff on there. I saw like,
oh, I know.
What was one of the advertisers? It was like this. Oh, dude. It's an interesting place. There's like this snail juice for like rejuvenation that you can put on your, I don't know, man, like on your face.
Put on your what?
Your face, I assume, is what it's like, some kind of wrinkle reducer or whatever. It's just, I don't know, man. There's some questionable stuff over there. Not that there's not questionable stuff here. And so they just make it so much more infinitely accessible. I love it. I think AliExpress is cool. I get tons of like little electronics and junk off of there.
Yeah, I've bought my share of things on there. Now you've reminded me about it again and I don't have to work tomorrow. So
you can go down that rabbit hole.
It cost me money.
Oh man. So what did I do last week as well? So whenever I play pickleball, I wear running shoes cause I'm getting old and they're like awesome on my knees or more so anyway, but I always drag my right foot. That's just kind of my play style. And so it eats off the toe of those jokers really quick. So I have to build it back up. So I've gone through lots of different various ways of doing it. And my best way of repairing it is I get super glue. I get the extra thin super glue and you do kind of a coat on the end of it, right? So it gets on the rubber, it gets on the kind of the cloth material at the top. And then I'm not sure if you've ever done this or not, but I fill in all the gaps where it wore off. I put baking soda, and then you drip that thin super glue on there. And it has this chemical reaction where it like instantly hardens. It's very caustic, so you got to have good ventilation because it will like singe your nostrils. But it instantly becomes like hard. It's like concrete. So then you just build up layers of that. And so I build up a nice like hard layer of the super glue and baking soda. And then over the top of that, I get these little rubber things called boot savers. And I just E6000 is like an adhesive. That's like one of my favorite universal adhesives. It's the only ever thing that I've found that can adhere. Like, so the NeoPixel lights, those strips, they come in those silicone sleeves, and it will actually stick that silicone to other stuff. It's the only thing I've ever found that does it. Huh. So that stuff, I use E6000. I put those little boot saver tips over the end. So I eventually wear through them because they're just rubber. But then when it hits that hard plastic or that hard, I don't know what you would call it, compound. It's like super glue concrete or whatever. Whenever it hits that stuff, like even outdoors, you can just, it leaves like white scrape marks on the concrete. So it very much keeps the shoe intact. But it's great for like filling gaps. It's not the prettiest thing you've ever seen, but like if you've got a gap in something and you need to fill it really quick, you can just kind of scuff it up to give the super glue some adhesive surface, you know, something to bite onto. And then you just fill in the gap with baking soda, smooth it off, and then because I mean, you can sand it, you can drill it, tap it, you can do whatever you want when it's done. And it, I mean, it's really fast.
I've never heard of this. Yeah, skateboard fix all for shoes was always shoe goo and duct tape.
Shoe goo and duct tape.
Shoe, man, for years I was running around with, I mean, I have shoes now that have shoe goo on because, you know, I've worn a hole in the side or whatever. But like duct tape, when I was in high school and college, like I didn't have any money. You know, I buy a pair of Vans, they're like $50 and $60, whatever they are. And they got to last me for probably 3 months. And when you're skating in shoes, I mean, the grip tape just eats them apart. And so I had rolls and rolls of duct tape. It was funny because, like, you know, my friends would always joke that, like, I just put duct tape on everything because I did. It was on shoes. It was on my car. It was on the board. It was just, it was everywhere. But the shoe goo, you know, it's like this, basically this, you know, liquidish rubber that once it hits oxygen, it hardens. And it's like, you know, it's like the bottom of a shoe at that point. And you put it on the side or the front or wherever it's wearing off. If you wore a hole in the bottom, you can used to put like a piece of, you pull out the, if you're lucky enough to have shoes that had the insoles in them, Vans didn't take them out. Right. So you'd have to put like a piece of cardboard in there and you put shoe goo on the bottom of it up to the cardboard, and then you just put something on top of it to hold it down while it dried. And then if you're lucky, you could get the piece of cardboard out when you were done. But I did that for years, man.
That's pretty redneck, brother.
Well, you know, I'm not Mike Hammett growing up on the farm in Illinois, but I grew up in a farm town in Illinois.
So. I gotcha. I use a lot of gaff tape. You ever use that stuff?
Gaffer's tape? Yeah. For, pull it right back off.
Yeah. For the people listening, I was introduced to it when I started working for the Grizzlies. So they use it a lot in entertainment, right? And in sports arenas, I guess, fall under that entertainment. But they would use this stuff for everything. And it's a cross between duct tape and kind of cloth. It's like a cloth back duct tape that's also made to let go of surfaces without leaving a residue, right? So it sticks to itself really well, but then it will still kind of come back off. And so it's really, I mean, it's easy to rip into strips to make it smaller, and
it tears like duct tape.
Oh, yeah. It's just, I don't know. I really like it compared to duct tape. I usually keep really cheap. I'm looking up there because that's where I keep all my crap. Usually you can see it right up there in the corner.
Right next to the sticker that says Chubbies.
Yeah. Can you see? Oh, yeah, you can see that. Yeah, it says Chubbies up there.
I've been staring at that the whole time, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, they make shorts. They're really nice. So I've got like some of my longboard stickers and stuff on my drill press, like Speed Demon and all that stuff. I longboard for a while. I don't do it a whole lot anymore, but I did it for a little minute. But yeah. I like gaff tape a lot. It's more expensive than duct tape, but I don't go through it very fast. And I've still got the same two rolls that I brought with me from Memphis back here to Texas. And I still use it fairly regularly, probably once every week and a half or 2 weeks to do something. I usually, especially like if I'm gluing something, it's really good for like applying the glue and then taping it up really solidly, and then you know it's going to come back off your surface really easy.
Yeah, when I was first at the Supercomputing Center back in, I started in like 2002, we supported this thing called the Access Grid, and what it was a big multicast AV system. So basically like this thing like we're doing now, it was like that, but in 2002. So it was all done with inter-domain multicast. And we had this bunch of rigs we would take to meetings. And for anybody that couldn't go, you know, they were out of campus and ideally they had multicast support. So we'd go to, and we'd set these things up and we'd gaffers tape down all the AV stuff and the, you know, the cords for the cameras and all, because none of it was IP based back then. Like there was a big PC that did the conversion to IP multicast. And so we had all these like microphones and stuff everywhere. And we used, that was where I discovered gaffer's tape. And I was like, man, where has this been my whole life? Cause like you can do all kinds of stuff with it. And you, and when you're done, it just goes away and you never know it was even there.
Oh yeah. It's baller. It's awesome.
Real prevalent in the, and you're right, in the, like the AV space.
All right, man. Let's pivot to the last, we're at like an hour, dude. I don't know if you realize that.
No.
I've eaten a ton of your time already. So let's pivot to the last thing that, that I particularly wanted to talk to you about. And it's, I think we've already sort of touched on it here and there in this. It's dealing with anxiety, you know, in our professional and personal lives. And IT, I find for most people seems to be very cyclical, right? The workload and the stress sort of go up and then they'll subside. They'll go up and they'll subside. And I don't know anybody that's ever worked in IT that hasn't been burned out or wouldn't quantify at some point like, hey, yeah, I was really burned out then. Or a lot of people don't want to say it while they're in it, you know, and sometimes I guess it takes a little distance to see it, but you know, it's how do you deal with that in various ways? And I know how I deal with it. I have a lot of cute coping mechanisms for all the various things that happen in my life.
Cute.
Yeah. But everybody's different, right? And I was just curious to see what your perspective was on that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because like when we talked about, you know, earlier, whenever, like I said, I was a lot different, you know, 20 years ago,
right.
18.
Who is it? Whenever, right? We all change.
But like I had, for lack of any better way to describe it, I had no fucks given. Like I just didn't care. I was young and I was full of piss and vinegar. And I was, frankly, it was a little bit angry that I felt like I had been told I didn't belong doing the thing that I was doing. And so I didn't have any anxiety. And then as I started to realize, like, that's all created in my head. Like nobody really thinks that, or maybe somebody does, right? But why do I care? And so then I started to like care about, like, I want to do a good job. Now I grew up with a really strong work ethic. You know, my grandpa was a brick mason. I was always doing manual stuff. And you know, and I'd been working since I was about probably 11. I had a paper route and, you know, I had all those things. So I've been working. I took a lot of pride in my work and I started to realize like, man, I want to do the best job I can. I want people to know about it. Like I want credit for things.
Yeah.
And that just started ramping my anxiety up. And for a long time, I didn't deal with it very well. Like I just would drink beers. You know, basically is how I dealt with it then, you know, my 20s, realized that was not productive, you know, nothing, you wake up feeling crummy every day. That's, you know, that's not great. And so I just started getting back into hobbies that I'd kind of given up. And I tend to be, anyone that's ever talked to me or seen me write about anything or whatever, I tend to be fairly obsessive about things. Like I want to know everything there is to know about whatever it is I'm doing. And I will lose time to do that. And so like I don't sleep much anyway, and I would just stay up and just learn and learn and learn and learn. And that was one way that I would deal with some of those things, because it would focus my brain on one thing and I wouldn't worry about stuff. But then after a while I realized that's probably not healthy either. And so I tried to start finding things that were outside of IT. Like I started wrestling again. I did triathlons for a while. I tend to gravitate towards extreme things. I started skateboarding more. And then, you know, as I've gotten older, you know, the anxiety never really goes away. And once you have kids, it's like amplified tenfold, right? Because I'm always worrying about my kids, right? I don't want them to have to deal with the stuff that I had to deal with. And so it's my anxiety. And so I just try to find creative outlets for things. I have a creative mind. And so I draw and I do illustrations and I make jewelry and I do, you know, basically something to get, I don't deal with emotion very well. I don't have a whole lot of it. And so like the way that that comes out is usually in some sort of creative process. And that's typically how I will deal with anxiety. Sometimes I don't do it very well, but like, and sometimes I don't have the opportunity, and that's where it becomes very hard, right? Because if you have work responsibilities, you have family responsibilities, and then, you know, your kids get to be a certain age, you're carting them all over the place and they've got activities and stuff, and you don't want them to know you're anxious about something, right? You know, but you want them to be kids. And so, you know, you may have to, like what I'll do is I'll just stay up late and I'll go in the garage and I'll make a ring, or, you know, or I'll sit at the table and do an illustration or whatever after everybody's gone to bed to just slow down my brain and refocus it away from whatever it is that's causing my anxiety. And I think I've just come to terms with the fact that it's not gonna go away. Like, I just have to deal with it. Like, and I have to deal with it in a constructive way.
So do you think the way you approached and dealt with anxiety changed once you got married? Do you think your partner had anything to do with how you looked at stress or how you dealt with stress?
Well, she definitely, I mean, we've been together since we were in high school, so we've known each other a long time, and she's kind of the brains of the operation, and, you know, she's very smart, she's rational, and, you know, I tend to be a bit of a, I'm going to jump off the roof and figure.
Hey, you're back.
Hey, there you are. So anyway, she's, you know, she's a veterinarian. She's very methodical. She's intelligent. So she helps me sort of. I didn't quite catch that. Could you? Weird. My phone's asking me questions. So, you know, she helps me with that a lot. Like, she'll be the rational voice in my head. It's gotten, as I've gotten older, I've needed it less and less, but she definitely helps me. But it didn't really change when I got married, because she had just started veterinary school. So I was basically still a single guy, like not single, but like she was not home much.
Right, you're on your
own. She was school or studying or whatever, doing a residency. So I was left to my own devices for 4 years after that. And then once she got out of school, then that's when I think, boy, how old was I at that point? I think it was 30 or 31. That's when I think I finally realized, like, hey, you're an adult now. Like, you gotta, like, be responsible. And I was always responsible. I paid bills and, you know, whatever. But, like, you know, I just kind of stopped being an idiot. Well, I became less of an idiot.
Right.
But, like, that's when it happened for me. And then, but that shifts things though, right? It takes one anxiety and it just changes it into another one. It doesn't really make it go away. Cause then, you know, you want to make sure that like everybody's happy and, you know, you're getting along, and the things that are important change, I guess. And that's why that the things that you worry about are going
to
change.
Something else is more important to you. So now you're going to worry about that thing more, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had been fairly career focused. And now, I mean, I still am. I love what I'm doing. If I didn't love what I'm doing, I wouldn't do it. Like, I like technology, but if I didn't like it anymore, I'd go do something else, you know, probably make a lot less money. And, but, you know, this is, for me, it was a harsh realization for me to realize, like, money's awesome and I like having it. Cause I didn't have any, you know, we were okay, but like, you know, I wasn't like rich or anything when I was a kid. Like, I had jobs and I had to pay for my own things and whatever. And, you know, when I had it, I was like, wow, you know, I'm making money now, but I hate this job.
Right.
Like, I had two jobs right in a row that were just like migraine inducing. Like, I get migraines. I've gotten them my whole life. I had more migraines in that year than I'd had in probably 5 or 6 years put together before that. Wow. Because I hated the jobs. They were IT jobs and they paid awesome. But like, it was ironically, it was when I was doing enterprise networking. Like, I could not deal with it. And you know, I ended up saying, you know, I'm going to take a pay cut. I took a huge pay cut to go from an enterprise security job at the time, what was the largest private network in the world, to rebuilding an outdated and aging internet regional internet provider. Like, I took like a $15,000 a year pay cut to go do that. And when I was the sole provider at the time, but I went from being miserable to being like excited about going to work every day. And that was huge to me. And that was when that painful realization of, you should do what you love as long as you can live off of it, right? And you may have to make some adjustments, but if that will make you happier, like, being rich is not worth being miserable. I wouldn't say rich, but like, you know, you get the point. Yeah. Like, I'm making an exaggeration to make a point.
Absolutely. It's interesting. So, I mean, everybody everywhere, their workload shifts, right? And when you feel yourself starting to get in one of those cycles where it's really ramping up, things are starting to get on top of you. I mean, do you have any strategies, anything you do to kind of help combat that?
Yeah. I mean, usually try to disconnect. Like, if I can, I just disconnect for the longest period of time that I can get away with. Sometimes that's an hour and sometimes that's maybe a day or two. To just kind of like, I need to refocus on something else, right? Just walk away from it for a bit. And I actually learned that in art school. Like, sometimes done is better than finished. And I just took that concept and said, you know, when I'm working on something, I'm going to nitpick it. Like, I hate all my own artwork. Always have. Probably always will. But, you know, it's something I have to do and something I enjoy doing. I'll never like the outcome. But at some point, I just have to say, like, I'm going to step away from this for a little while. Maybe I'll come back and make some tweaks later. And maybe I won't. But like, I took that concept to like, okay, I'm overwhelmed with what I'm doing at work. You know, as long as it's not fire, like, oh my gosh, you know, someone hijacked our /16 or what, you know, that's a fire, right? I got to deal with that on the spot. But like, if I've got this problem I can't deal with, I have whatever's going on, you know, I can't figure out how to make this thing work or whatever, let's step away from it for a day. Just go do something else for a little bit. That may be something technical, it may be something totally unrelated. I have to be able to do that. That's the only way I can function as a human in society without like going bananas.
You
know,
it's funny what you said about your art is I heard the quote, I'm not sure who said it, but they said, no artist ever finishes their work. They just abandon it. So at some point they have to just pull the ripcord and say, I've got to stop now, because it'll never be perfect. It'll never be exactly right.
I learned it early on, and I had forgotten about it for a long time. When I started getting back into it again, I follow this guy. All my art stuff is on Instagram, right? Like, all my skateboarding, and I like vintage toys and, you know, stuff like that, pop culture stuff. Totally non-technical, right? That's like my happy place. And I was following this guy on there. He's like a illustrator from Indiana. He's not too far away from me. Skateboarder, you know, is my age. Went to art school at the same time. Very similar, except for he's a really good artist. And he's done a bunch of stuff, like a bunch of like how to's, and like, it's not just like, how do you do this technique, right? It's like, how do you deal with the fact when I'm like, I have a basically artist equivalent of writer's block. And one of those things he did was basically a long write-up of done is better than perfect, right? Because there, in my mind, there is no such thing as perfection.
Yeah, never.
Right? It doesn't exist. So like, at some point you have to say, this is the way it's going to be now. And I'm handing it to you, or I'm throwing it in the garbage can. I'm done with it at this point, right? It's finished. I'm not going to make any more changes to it. And I think that's applicable to technology too, right? There's no network that's going to get built that's 100% the way you expect it's going to be. There's always going to be one-offs, right? And you have to be okay with that. And a lot of technical people are very binary minded. Like, it's either right or it's wrong. It's on or it's off. it's black or it's white, and that's never the case. And I think that induces a lot of anxiety in highly technical people where things are not inside the box. And being able to say, this is not in the box, it's gray, and I'm okay with that. I'm just going to make a note of it. It'll be documented. And when something happens with it, it is a noted one-off and we know it.
Yeah, for sure. And I've never seen anything that goes 100% according to a template, right? There's always variances. And, you know, anything that's ever made by humans is imperfect. So you just have to go into it understanding that while we are imperfect machines, we are going to continue to make imperfect things. I used to have a boss. He read this executive book called Good is the Enemy of Great. And he was trying to tell me about it. And I was telling him, well, he wasn't my boss. He was like he was way up there. But I was telling him that, you know, that perfection is the enemy of good. I was like, I basically said the opposite of what he said. I was like, great is the enemy of good. To me, in my mind, as soon as he said that and started arguing his point, I said, this is a man who's never had 10 people dying in front of him. And he's got to figure out who he's going to save and who he's going to let go. You know what I mean?
Right.
As in IT, yep. He hit that triage. You said it earlier. It's triage. That's 100% what it is. If there's more than one thing on fire and you know there's a dollar value associated with each thing being down for X amount of time, you've got some hard decisions to make. You're not picking up the phone. You're not calling somebody else and asking if they can help. You're not, you know what I mean? It's like you've got to make a decision now. This is a guy that's always been in sales. And not to say that salespeople don't work hard and have tough jobs, because I know some of them that they really do, but they don't generally have these life and death situations in front of them, you know, occasionally. And so to tell me that everything needs to be as perfect as we possibly can make it, it's like you don't understand real expectations and you're not set, you know, because I think a lot of people too, if their management's not setting good expectations, that's a failure on their part, right? If somebody dictates to you, like he told me one time, make sure this never happens again. Seriously, you're telling me that right now? And so it's the way he said it was almost, make sure this never happens again or it's your job. And it's, you know, it's in IT, it's an imperfect system. While I feel sometimes more like we are herding cats, I mean, we're good at herding cats, but that doesn't mean the cat's not going to decide to just take a nap. You know, and it feels like sometimes you're put into a failure situation where you know it's going to fail, but you still have to do it to the best of your ability. And sometimes I think some people don't thrive in those situations. And I 100% get that. You know, I 100% understand that, you know, and I've had anxiety for a long time. It took me a long time to figure out that's what it was, because I remember like in middle school, before going to school every morning, I feel like I was going to throw up. I had no idea why. And then I remember throwing up at school one time. You weren't supposed to go in, but I went in early. And they were like, what are you doing in here? I was like, I got to throw up. And so they let me by. And of course, I puked 5 foot before the bathroom. I didn't make it. And I walked back and looked at them and just said, I didn't make it. Sorry. And then went along my way.
Sawdust stuff and put on.
Yeah, it's like, hope you got some cat litter. But I don't know, man. It's like I would be anxious and I had no idea why. You know, and it's that kind of stuff just sits on top of you sometimes. And it would come and it would go. But later in life, I found a coping mechanism. And it was exercise. And I didn't realize, it took me a long time to realize that. So regular exercise, I started, my wife got me off the couch and I ended up losing, I think 45 pounds or something. I was like 225 and I went down to like 180. But I just started exercising a little bit. She got me to get up and start walking. And then we started jogging a little bit and I stuck with it for over 10 years until my body just couldn't handle it anymore. And when I would hit a gap where I would have to stop, like I'd get injured or something would happen, I would just start getting really short. Like I had no patience and I would just be so irritable. And I just couldn't figure out why. And I eventually learned that I was regularly releasing dopamine in my brain and, you know, the exercise. And man, so when I really had to quit running, my body just couldn't handle it anymore. 'Cause I'm old and everything's trash. I switched over to cycling. Like if I have at least a minimum 2 times a week of hard cardio where I push myself, I'm usually close to double what everybody else's output is in those classes. And I guess they're there for exercise. I'm there to keep myself sane. So I got to push myself.
I got a rowing machine and weights in the basement. That's exactly for that. I had to stop running too. Back injuries, knees being bad. Yeah. And I talk about skateboarding, knees but I, back, you know, yeah. That's the reason. Yeah, I got a rowing machine and stuff. And I still wrestle. I go wrestle with the cops. The police training institute's like, you know, right over there. And I'll go over there and we'll do submission wrestling. I've been doing that for 20 years. And so, you know, but they're older like me. So they're not like, you know, it's not like a 45-year-old man wrestling with a 20-year-old kid because that's a nightmare. I've done it. Last time I did that, I popped a ligament in my ankle. And then I was a real butthole for about 4 months because I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
My wife used to literally tell me, why don't you go downstairs and lift weights for like a half an hour? Yeah. And what she was telling me was, you're being a dick.
Yeah. But it's amazing because I know a lot of guys in IT that are just lethargic, sedentary, right? There, the way they turn off is they just play video games. That's what I did too. And not to say that's not okay and that's fine, but folks with a lot of anxiety, like if something blew up, my favorite thing to do would be come home, especially in the middle of the summer, it'd be 101 degrees and I would go for a run in the middle of the heat. And the worse my body felt during it, the better I would mentally feel after it. And it's just something about that hard exertion that is really good for me. So I think a lot of people just underestimate how much power there is in like some kind of like you do weights. For me, it's cardio, like hard cardio, even if it's like cycle class, 45 minutes. I kick myself hard for 45 minutes twice a week. That's it. And it keeps me solid. Yeah. I mean,
I do circuit training. I mean, it's weights, but it's like, I don't do heavy stuff anymore because my body just can't do it. So I just do lots of reps and I do a circuit. I don't want to call it, it's not CrossFit, but it's conceptually similar, right? And it's the way we trained when I wrestled, you know, like was like, let's do full body workouts kind of thing. And you do that like 3 times a week, man, and it'll keep you sane. Just basically just any kind of endorphin inducing exercise is huge. Yeah. That and doing something creative, those are my go-tos.
Yeah, you mentioned creative. I love that too. You know, but for me, what I really like too, it's something very detail-oriented, right? To where I have to focus. I have to focus on this thing I'm doing. You said non-technical. I like making things. I like challenging myself. It doesn't matter what it is. One time we made, you remember those rip sticks? They're like 2-wheeled skateboard things that would wobble. You'd see the kids. We made a rigged version of that just to see if we could do it. And then I made a boat out of PVC, made a flamethrower, made, you know, just whatever. Also like doing LEDs and stuff like that and soldering. So it's technical, but it's just very detail oriented and focused, right? Where you kind of turn everything else off while you're doing that. I love doing that too.
That's jewelry design for me is the, you know, the soldering and the detail stuff. I'm not a detail person, except for then. I will happily glaze over every detail that you will allow me to glaze over. Unless I'm doing that particular thing, and then I want to focus wholly on that. And that you can always tell when I've had a particularly stressful time when I go and do that.
For me too, it's like when I make something, I don't want it. Generally, I don't want it at the end. I enjoy the act of doing it, the challenge of trying to complete it. And then after that, I want it gone. You said you're a pseudo hoarder. I'm kind of the opposite. I purge everything. I want it all gone.
Well, I'm a hoarder when it comes to certain things. Like when I make something, I often give it away. Like I make a lot of rings, and people always say, well, let me commission you to make this ring. I'm like, no, I don't want to get paid for it because then it's a job. Right. You pay for the materials. I will make it and give it to you. Like I don't want to make it a job. Yeah. Like, cause then it is a job. But so, but for like my stuff, like toys, especially for me, like I love toys. Like,
well, I see them, dude. That you're nostalgic for, or can it be anything?
Yeah, it's all stuff that like a lot of it is stuff that was mine when I was a kid. But like the things I don't have anymore, I want them again. Like I found, so I had this from when I was in the Star Wars fan club in the early 80s. I've been looking for this for years. Gosh, finally found a dude that had it, and not only did he have that, he had both colorways. So like this kind of stuff, like I'll never give that up. Like that'll probably go, one of them will go on a hat and the other ones will go in my archive, which is like a display thing that I've got. But I've got so much of that stuff. Like I regret every minute like that I gave up my 1980s Star Wars toys. Like I have all the ones that were super important to me, but like I had a lot of them and I don't have most of them now. Like I still have my original Boba Fett and IG-88 and all that stuff, and I have the bigger ones and whatever, but like I hoard my toys. Like I will never get rid of those.
Do you find most of your pleasure in the hunt, the acquisition of these things, or is it the actual being able to look at them and then knowing that you have them? Where do you find the most joy?
It's different, right? I mean, the hunt is always fun. Like finding, it's so hard to find them. Like in the 90s, it wasn't that hard to find them, right? Like the stuff, I started amassing this stuff around probably 90. Well, right when I got out of high school in 93, I started reacquiring these things. And I was also buying the re-release toys. Mm. At one point, I had every single thing that they re-released in the 90s still in the boxes. And I ended up selling those and buying a road bike because I had to stop running and I wanted to start cycling. Yeah. So, and I got a fair amount of money for those, but I kept, you know, pretty much all the really rare ones that I still have. But like back then you could go to flea markets and antique shops and you could find, you know, vintage Star Wars stuff for pennies on the dollar. They're giving it away basically. And then, you know, when buzz of the new movies started coming out at the end of the 90s, then it started to balloon. Right. It became a little bit harder to find. Now it's really hard to find stuff for any kind of good price.
So have you taken your kids to see like all of the new Star Wars movies and stuff like that, you guys?
We just saw the last one. We just came back from Disney World where they had the Hollywood Studios had the all the Star Wars stuff and bought lights. That was their Christmas.
Oh, that's cool.
We made the like metal lightsabers. I don't have mine. It's hanging in my office at work, but I mean, it's like a legit lightsaber. It does everything except cut off arms. You know, it's pretty dope. And they each got one of those. And I'm more into it than they are, but like so they think it's
cool too. Do you get that? Do you get that same hit that you had as a kid going to see it? Whenever you kind of take your kids, kind of relive it through them. Do you get kind of that?
Yeah. I mean, for me, like there is no better, man, you opened a big can here, by the way. There's no better episode than Empire Strikes Back. Like that is the quintessential epitome of Star Wars to me. Cause it's a bummer. It's got Boba Fett, Han gets frozen. You know, it's like, it's, you know, Luke gets his hand cut off. He realizes Vader's his father. You know, it's just like everything all at once. It's like an emotional overload. Return is great too, but then like the prequels, I don't even recognize those.
Okay. You're not a Jar Jar Binks fan then.
I waited like 18 hours to see episode one in line and was, so I'm a little sour about that stuff. Yeah. But Rogue One was fantastic. Like I rank that up there with Empire because it's self-contained. If you haven't seen it, you should watch it.
I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm not a Star Wars fan. I'm not a Star Trek fan either. So I'm agnostic. I like to think of myself. I did see the Solo movie because it had
Donald Glover.
Yeah. Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Donald Glover was in it. Yeah. Childish Gambino. I like him a lot. Like I loved him in Community and stuff. And I thought, as just like a standalone movie, I thought that was really good. Like I enjoyed
that.
Yeah. I know there's purists that didn't exactly like it, but...
I don't care what they think. I'm writing the song. I liked it.
That's cool. All right, so...
I better button this up.
We got to get out of here. Yeah, man, like I was just saying, we were talking about anxiety and stuff like that. I know some people medicate and that's okay. I think if it helps you get to a place you need to be, I just think there's a lot of people that haven't looked at alternatives, you know, and I know it's hard to start something new. We're coming up on New Year's, right? Everybody wants to start a resolution. Why not? I don't do resolutions because I like to be anti-authoritarian, so it just makes me want to not complete them. But yep. I do like challenging myself. That's something I do is regularly I'll challenge myself to something. You know, I'll pick a thing and I'll learn it to some degree of competency, and then I'll move on to something else. So this could be your chance to try exercising or pick up maybe some kind of a detail-oriented hobby. One that doesn't necessarily just turn off your brain like video games. One that there is, at the end of it, an outcome, right? You have a thing. You've made a thing. You've created a thing. You've written a thing. You've, you know, whatever it happens to be. So, again, Nick, thank you so much for coming on here and talking with me. I think this is probably far more entertaining to have multiple personalities on here. If you wanted people to get a hold of you, how would you like them to do that?
I've got a blog. It's forwardingplane.net. I've put a couple other things that I've done on there recently. And I've got a Twitter. It's forwardingplane that I look at occasionally. If you want to see any of my art stuff, it's just Braulio on Instagram. And then I'm on the Little Brothers Wisp Slack.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you're always very attentive on there. If you want to...
Much to most people's chagrin.
No, man.
Guys talking
I love
again.
Everything on there. I love everything. All of you are my favorite children. I don't like anyone better than the other. No. But on the Little Brothers Wisp Slack, that's patreon.com/Brothers Wisp. Throw us a couple bones, you can get in there. We might be switching platforms soon, so we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll do Matters Most. Maybe we'll do Discord. I don't know. Everybody's clamoring for something, so we got to do something soon.
Yeah, it's the community that matters, not the mechanism, and it's worth
it. Yeah. And
I learn stuff on there.
I learn stuff daily on there, and sometimes it's hard for me to keep up with you guys. But yeah, you can also find me gregatgregsoul.com, a very occasionally blog on there, not nearly as frequently as this guy right here, nor is the content very good anymore. It's usually just very cursory information. Questions, comments, I don't want to keep them coming. Thank you guys for listening.
So people can start searching, shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.